My guest is Thomas Tip O'Neill, Speaker of the House of Representatives for 10 years until his retirement this past January. O'Neill was elected to Congress in 1952, winning the seat that John Kennedy vacated when he ran for the Senate. Like Kennedy before him, O'Neill came from a political family. His father was a Boston City Councilman. As a liberal Democrat from perhaps the most liberal congressional district in the country, O'Neill rose quickly through the House ranks in the late 50s and early 60s. But his reputation as a loyal team player was shaken in 1967 when he became one of the first and most prominent Democrats to break with Lyndon Johnson over the Vietnam War. In his last year as a Speaker of the House, O'Neill was President Reagan's principal foe, leading the opposition to aid for the Contras and propose cuts in social welfare programs. Tip O'Neill has just written a memoir. It's titled Man of the House, The Life and Political Memoirs of Tip O'Neill, and it's published by Random House. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Terry, delighted to be with you.
When you got to the House, Sam Rayburn was the Speaker. And one of the things, I think this was in the House, he told you that he needed a vote from you in exchange for a favor he'd done for you, and that this is a vote you didn't want to give him. But he said, if I really need this vote, I'm going to signal you, and then you just have to vote that way in exchange for this favor.
Well, that's not exactly it, but what happened was a fellow by the name of Judge O'Brien from Albany, New York, and the O'Connells, political organization, they controlled the organization. They said they wanted to go down and see Sam Rayburn. So they went in and saw Sam, and they said, we have a tax problem. And the tax problem is that it's an Internal Revenue problem, and they've been sitting on it for 3 years. So the truth of the matter was that Sam took care of it, with something you wouldn't do ethically today. And when he came back, they thanked him. They said, O'Brien is the congressman from our district. He'll be happy to give you any vote that you want. And the educational bill was coming up, or rather the offshore bill was coming up, and whether the money would go to the National Education Fund or would it go back to the states. And they said, he'll vote any way you want. And he acquiesced, and Sam said, I never did a quid pro quo in my life. But he said, you've given me your word, fine, I hope you'll stay with it. Well, time came for the vote, and O'Brien said, gee, this is terrible. You know, I can't give him a vote. It's against the principles. The papers at home know about it. So he went in to see Mr. Rayburn. Mr. Rayburn said, you know, I didn't ask you for your vote. You promised it to me. I never did a quid pro quo in my life, this for that. But he said, I'll tell you, I expect you to keep your word. And he said, you go out into the House, onto the floor. And he said, if I need your vote, I expect you'll vote for me. If I don't need your vote, he said, old Fishbait Miller would give you the signal and you vote the other way. Well, the interesting thing about that was a very important piece of legislation. Offshore oil, would it go to the states? Offshore oil, would it go to an national education program? We, who were advocating education, lost that bill, 209 votes to 203. O'Brien voted with us. How close it was. Yet as I looked at the first row, Sam Rayburn had 17 fellows that he could have turned against the bill at any particular time.
Well, here's my question. Yes. When you became Speaker of the House, you saw how Rayburn had done it. Did you ever try anything like that?
Oh, no. The ethics of politics had changed.
So how has it changed since the days when you entered the Senate?
Well, old Sam, as I look at him, he didn't, other than the chairman of the House, he didn't know 20 members of the House. He was one of the most powerful figures in America, and power is when people believe you had power. And he could call the Internal Revenue, or he could call a cabinet member, say, be in my office at such and such a time, and they would be there. He'd call a committee chairman and say, I want you to put this in your budget or in the appropriation bill, or I want this tacked on as an amendment on a bill that you're writing. No such a thing happens today. Everything is out there with subcommittee chairman, and the press is following it on a day-by-day basis. So the ethics, the power, the style of politics has just completely changed in a period of 30 years.
When you were Speaker of the Massachusetts House, and here's a story I might fracture again, so help me out if I do. When you were Speaker of the Massachusetts House, you needed to chase down some votes, and there was one congressman you were looking for, and you couldn't find him. You finally found him in a stall of the men's room with his feet up so that you couldn't even see his feet beneath, but you knew he was in there. So you got him out. So, did you ever have to try tactics like that when you were Speaker of the House?
I didn't have that. You know, when I was Speaker of the Massachusetts House, each legislator was... he got so much patronage. He probably got 25 jobs and three trucks and things like that that were on the state programs and things like that. So every Monday you'd go over the patronage list, who was doing this and who was doing that, and were they following faithfully along with the governor's program. And if they didn't, you automatically cut them off, and they lost jobs. And those were days when the times were tough in America. But all of that is the politics of bygone days. That's the way it operated. Nothing like that. Speaker of the House had no patronage. The powerful position of the Speaker is the power of scheduling the legislature. I can sign a note and send a man around the world on a trip or something of that, or occasionally there's a page. But you don't talk about patronage in the Congress of the United States. That's the difference in the state politics of years ago and the politics that I saw enlarge in the Congress of our government.
You write about, in your memoir, you write about the post-Watergate breed of congressmen who came in who had more success because of television, and they had more, they'd won more from TV than they'd gotten from their party machine. The party machine just wasn't that important to them. And you felt that to them, you represented the establishment, an old fogey of politics. Did you really resent having that kind of image to the younger congressmen?
No, as a matter of fact, I was fortunate. My image was fairly good with the new congressmen that were coming in. Most of them were anti-Vietnam War. I was the first of the establishment politician who led the fight against the war. And so I had that going in my favor. We had 92 new Democrats elected in 1974. So many of them. We never dreamed that Republicans who were in the Congress for 30 years, 25 years, and things like that would ever be defeated. And young fellows got elected, and they had the D beside their name, and they came to Congress. They said, we would never have been here if the party thought we could have won. The party didn't help us. The party didn't support us. They didn't even have anybody running. We filled in. We're the ones that put the organization together. We're the ones that raised the money. I am here, and I'm not beholden to anybody. So that's what that was all about. And at that particular time, they fired two or three. You voted, of course, for the chairman of the committees, and they fired, I believe, the first time around, either two or three chairmen that they didn't like. They were a tremendous factor in our caucus. We had probably 270, 280, I don't recall the number, but they were better than one-third of them. So they stayed together as a caucus, and they were a power. But I got along with them well because of the fact that I was a key figure in the impeachment trials and putting Watergate before the House and on the Vietnam. But they were tough, believe me.
Because of television, I think congressmen are more visually attractive than they used to be in a way, you know, because people who get elected are the people with the really nice haircuts and the youthful good looks. Did you feel that there was more narcissism in Congress in the last 10 years?
Well, I would have to say that, no question about it. people say to me, how far do you think you would have gone if you were around on the age of television, when I've been on television for years, but we never use it. I never used television for the most part until I became Speaker of the House. What would the chances of a fellow with gray hair and bulbous nose and cabbage ears and overweight have? I don't know. I don't know what would have been my chances. But today, it's the medium. How do you handle it? Look at the President of the United States. God gave him a beautiful physique, a handsome face, a cultured voice. And he remembers his line, and he's entranced the nation. They loved him just because of his ability to dialogue with the American people in a friendly fashion. That's one of the attributes of politics today. You have to be able to handle the media, you have to be able to handle the mic, and you have to be able to have yourself well groomed.
You know, you wrote a little bit about how some of the younger congressmen saw you as the establishment. And I wonder if you ever felt that smoking a cigar and being identified with a cigar and with the golf course ever, you know, reinforced that image to any people?
Sure, I was buffooned by the cartoonist of America, you know, fat, overweight, cigar in your hand, the typical image.
don't know how cigars got so.
I was never much of a drinker, but they would always have a beer mug or something in front of me, or something of that nature. But I was able to overcome it without difficulties, because I stood for something and I had definite programs and I spoke my mind. And I had a political insight, and I had an ability to be able to lead, and I made decisions. I represented a highly educational area, probably more colleges in my district than any other, or more students in my district than any other district in the world. I never got along with the professors. They were never part. I was of my organization. The Backstreet people always elected me. But as Galbraith said, you know, he wanted to clean up the Charles River. He said 25 years before we ever heard of the environment. He was opposed to the war before the students were opposed to it. His intuition told him that something was wrong in the White House during the Nixon years. And I look with pride at my political insight. But I don't do it because of politics. Because I do it because I thought I was acting in the best interests of the country.
Tip O'Neill is my guest, and he's written a new memoir titled Man of the House. You really had a reputation for being a loyal politician and a team player, and you broke with the party and you broke with LBJ when you came out against the war in Vietnam. Was that a difficult thing to do?
That was an extremely difficult thing to do. I used to be briefed every Wednesday and Thursday, and Friday I'd go home to one of the 15 or 20 colleges that were in my district, and I would talk to the students advocating the policy of Lyndon Johnson, that we had every right over there. And one day I was at Boston College. My son and daughter were in the class. I'm talking to a group there, and they were giving me the question and answers, the same questions that were asked at Duke or North Carolina or at Wisconsin or at Berkeley. The pattern ran the same. We used to sit down and actually get the answers from Bunker, from Lodge, from Westmoreland, and people like that. And I was giving the routine answers. And a young fellow by the name of McCarthy, he was a senior. And he said, Mr. O'Neill, you say you've been briefed 44 times, that you've been briefed by 18 different people. You know more about this war than we do. Have you ever been briefed on the other side of the question? That night I'm at home and I said, you know, I've never been briefed on the other side of the question. Within a matter of a short period of time, I met with General Shock, who had just quit the Marines. And I said, you know, the war is bothering me. And we sat down. He said, I'm writing a book about it. He said, this war is wrong, wrong place, wrong time, not the right reasons. He said, here we are 10,000 miles away. 58th parallel, you can't shoot, you're being shot at. We don't mine the harbors. We don't knock out the bridge where they're bringing over the supplies. We don't knock out the generators of energy. He says the thing is wrong. And then I started to move around. I talked to assistant secretaries of state. I talked to CIA people. I talked to Army people and Navy people. I'm in Malta where my daughter was with the Foreign Service. I met the troops that were coming back, and they said, we don't know why we're there, but we resent the fact that it's being criticized at home. But it's awful when you're out there and you can't cross the parallel and you can't shoot until you're shot. And so I made my decision, and I came out against the war.
I guess I'm wondering, though, if you ever asked yourself, what is this going to do to my political career? Will it damage my political career to break ranks with the rest of the party?
Well, the interesting thing at that time, there were but very, very few, and those were some of the flag-burning students, who, when I changed my position, they hurt me tremendously. 85% of the people in the back streets where I got my vote, they agreed with the policy of Johnson. I was hurt very, very badly. As I would come down the street, I would actually see people cross the street when they saw me coming. What's O'Neill doing? Joining those radicals down on the square? And it hurt me tremendously. And I say in my book, I remember my conversation with my son Tom, my daughter Sue. I said, I think my political end has come. But I took all the speaking engagements in my area, whether it was the Kiwanis or the Knights of Columbus or the Elks or a Holy Name Society or whatever it was, church groups of all denominations. I went in and explained how I made my decision. And the American Legion, they called a big meeting. 800 people showed up. I tell a story about Red Fitzgerald, the pal of mine. They were criticizing me for changing my policy. Red said, "Tip's been in public life a long time. You and I are in the war. We wrote back whenever we had a problem, and Tip helped our families. During the years that we've been home, anytime you need something, you always go to Tip. We've had faith in him. We have trust in him. He knows more about this war and why he's did it than the rest of it." And it broke up the meeting. And I was very, very fortunate. I was lucky that particularly I had no opposition from either my own party or the Democratic Party. And as Johnson said, "Well, you're the first of the establishment, and you're highly regarded." And he said, "I hope you don't go out there talking to the press. The snowball will go against me." One of my regrets is that I didn't speak up more loudly right then. It was only a matter of time then, of course, that we really started moving. You need one person to start the snowball going, and ultimately we denied authorizations and appropriations, and the war came to an end. And I think history is going to prove that we were at the wrong place at that particular time.
Tip O'Neill is my guest. We're going to talk some more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Tip O'Neill is my guest, former Speaker of the House and author of a new memoir, which is titled Man of the House. I want to move up in time a little bit to just a few years ago when President Reagan was shot and he was immobilized, taken to the hospital. The vice president was inaccessible at the time. Now, the Constitution says that the next in line after the president is the vice president. Then you have the Senate pro tem and then the Speaker of the House.
No, the Speaker of the House and then the Senate pro tem.
So you're third in line.
Right.
Okay. So, but Al Haig took over and said, "I am in charge here." What went through your mind? Because, you were rightfully the next in line there for that brief period in time.
Well, no, that isn't the way it operates. The president, of course, hadn't been declared that he was indisposed to the extent that he couldn't run the presidency, and there was no turning over the powers to the vice president. The vice president was coming up and playing immediately. I'll never understand what was in Al Haig's place at that particular time. Of course, as a secretary of defense, he's fifth in line. But I was watching it on the television that day, and FEMA, the federal emergency, kept calling, you know, "Where are you? Are you everything all right?" They kept like a half an hour check.
Checking with you.
Checking on me, where I was and the whereabouts, and was this a national plot, and were they going after the leaders and things like that. And the answer was that I kept watching it on television, and I was surprised at Haig. I think that Haig went over to the White House at that particular time and just said, "Well, there's nobody, the vice president's out, the president's in the hospital. Within the party, I'm the next person, and I will take the telephone calls, and I will run." Probably the press may have misinterpreted the real depth of what his thought was. Did he think he was next in line for president? I really don't think that he thought that, really.
Were you very frightened during that period?
Well, it was just by chance that we had the television on in my office and was watching that because I was supposed to address the same group the next day. And we were commenting that, you don't have all that Secret Service. I got out, had no Secret Service. I'd be with my driver, hop out of the door and walk in. Look at all the aides that he has. And all of the people. Ed Meese was with him. Young fellow by the name of Ahern from Boston was working in the White House. He threw himself over the president, as you may remember. And there were so many in that picture. And I was shocked that, you know, we didn't know it, that the president has been shot. They put him in the hospital. 2 days later, at my press conference, and they'd say, "Well, have you talked to the president? Have you been over to the president? What kind of condition is the president in?" And no, I haven't. "Well, don't you think as the leader of the opposition that you ought to be talking with the president on different matters?" And Say, I kept pressing the question so that I called the White House and I said, do you think it would be proper for me to go over to see the president? I got a telephone call back, I think, from Mike Deaver. And he said, you go to see the president 2 o'clock the next afternoon. And I get into there, and I brought in a little Irish joke book because he's a great Irish storyteller. Thought it would bring a little mirth to him. I couldn't believe that the president was in the shape he was in. He was in pain, and then there was no reason in the world that I should have been there. And that was one of the kept secrets of the particular time. The president was far more seriously hurt than the American public thought he was at that time. He had a great constitution at his age and beautiful... health was in beautiful condition, and he was able to forego that serious wounds that he had.
But is your responsibility to not let the public know about that?
Oh, I never mentioned about the seriousness until later on. I mentioned in the book, you know, at that time. Matter of fact, my first reaction was, say some prayers for him. He was in tough shape.
I want to ask you something about the Bork hearings, which are going on now. In your book, you wrote that nowadays nobody wants to serve on the Judiciary Committee because it's too controversial, and you can't win if you take a stand on abortion or gun control or prayer in the schools. Do you think that people don't want to be associated with controversial issues today, more so than in the past?
Oh, no, there's no question about it. When I went to the Congress of the United States, the Judiciary Committee was a prime prize committee. Every lawyer that went to Washington, he wanted to participate. He wanted to be able to go home and say, I have made the Judiciary Committee. It was one of the ranking committees. As time went along, we couldn't get members to get on that committee. And as you say, for what reasons? Well, the reasons of changing the Constitution, the reason of abortion, the reason of flagging the schools, the reason of balanced budget, the reason of redlining, giving the president power of redlining the budget. So many things, gun control, came before the committee.
But politicians are more afraid of controversy than they used to be.
Well, Aiden, why invite controversy to those that type of issue? Why get yourself on a committee like that when energy is the big problem of America, or the transportation of America? And it turned from that day to days of, how can I help the economy of my area? If I am Philadelphia in a harbor, I want to get on the Merchant Marine Committee. If I'm from Boston, I want to get on the Merchant Marine Committee. If we're looking for a new network of roads, I want to get on the Public Roads Committee. How do I help the economy of the area? That became the thought. By helping the economy of the area, I can build myself with a solid base from the area. I don't want to get into these controversial issues where there's a positive and a negative side with people, activists, on both sides. All you can do is get hurt.
I was looking at a News and World Report article from June of 1980, and it was comparing the assets and liabilities financially of Capitol Hill leaders. And your assets were listed as $1,000
probably
in your savings account. And your outside income was $10,500 in honorariums and $6,408 in capital gains, pension, and interest. This was definitely the lowest lowest in income of every figure on that page.
That's probably true. The interesting thing, I was elected speaker, and the New York Times called me, and they said they want a net worth statement. I said, never made a net worth statement in my life. They said, we'll give you 3 hours to get a net worth statement, or we will send an investigatory team to make a net worth file. I said, all right, give me a couple of hours. I called back, and it was a Saturday afternoon. I said, I figured my net worth is $115,000. I have a home in Howardsport, and with a mortgage on it. I have a home in Cambridge with a mortgage on it. My assets of my automobiles, I don't have any money in the bank. I don't have any stock or anything of that nature. And the next day, they ran a front page story on it. My son called me on the telephone. He said, Dad, he said, I can't believe it. He said, I had more money than that when I was a senior in college. He said, gee, I never realized that my father was such a poor man. Well, I said, I want you to know that we educated, your mother and I educated 5 of you and kept the home fires burning, and I had to run back and forth before Washington.
We've all been noticing you in more ads now, the American Express ad, and you're in a new ad for Hush Puppies, along with Marvin Hagler, Lauren Hutton, and Deborah Harry.
Well, I don't know those people, but I do know Hagler, and he's a good friend of mine. And when they came to offer me the ad, I said, to be in an ad with Marvin Hagler, I would be honored to be in. And I think he's a great American. He's a champion. I always appreciate moving into the sports world and meeting champions, and it was a delight to do the ad.
Are you doing the ads as retirement income?
I think more than it helped, it served the ego more than it did the retirement. But true, I never had anything to equity to leave to my grandchildren, and I will be here. I'd like to build up a little equity for them.
During the years that you were serving in Washington, your family continued to live in Cambridge.
I lived in Cambridge for 25 years. We had a 14-room house there that Millie and I had bought very reasonably, and Millie was mother and father, and I commuted every weekend. And we were drained and we were strapped through most of that time.
Now that you're retired, are you learning to live together again? I mean, it must be.
Oh, Millie and I, Millie is saying to me, you're spending more time with your grandchildren than you ever spent with your own children, which is true. One of the sad parts of being away from your family and being in public life down in Washington. You know, I was so delighted the other day. My son, Tommy, my grandson, Tommy, he said to me, Grandpa, boy, am I glad you're retired. He said, we can see you more often. I want you to know, it thrilled me.
We only have about a minute left, but I have to ask you this. You know, whenever there's a State of the Union address, you see the Speaker of the House right behind the President, and it seems to me you'd have to be on your best behavior no matter what your temptation is. If you'd really like to be smirking or groaning due to what the President's saying, you can't do it because you're on camera. Is that a strain?
Well, that's interesting. You know, you're looking at the President, the back of the President, and you're looking over his shoulder at the teleprompter and you're reading along with him. And every once in a while I'd comment to Bush or Bush would comment to me. And we would jest back and forth. You just can't sit there for the 26 minutes in a span of about 40 minutes without saying anything. But I mean, that's not the normal thing to do. And so the normal thing is to comment along the line, with never any thought of any kind of a disrespect to the President who's standing up there addressing the nation.
Do you miss politics now?
Oh, of course I miss it. You just can't walk away after 50 years of it. Sure, I miss it. I miss making the decisions. I miss the briefings. I miss my colleagues. I miss my old staff. Miss the press, too.
Well, I want to thank you for talking to us about your political career. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Terry. It's a delight.
My guest has been former Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill, who's written a memoir titled Man of the House, and it's just been published by Random House. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.